This is James Robertson, CINCOM Smalltalk Product Evangelist, with a presentation that I gave to the Orlando Ruby Users Group about Seaside and the WebVelocity Beta on September 11th, 2008. I'm James Robertson. I'm the product evangelist for CINCOM Smalltalk. What I was going to ask is, how many people have some level of familiarity with Smalltalk? Okay, so it's not a huge number, but some of you have at least seen it. I only have a handful of slides, and the purpose behind these slides is just to give you an idea of what kind of code we're going to be looking at when I get into Seaside, so that what I'm showing you on the screen doesn't look like a complete mystery. So, just to give you an idea, let me proceed through a couple of these. Smalltalk is similar to Ruby in a lot of ways. I am not going to pretend to have a lot of knowledge of Ruby. I am not an expert. I've looked at it long enough to run some of the example applications. I think I can sort of kind of read the code. So, you know, I'm not an expert, and I'm not here to say anything about Ruby, positive or negative, really. That's not really my purpose. I figure that you guys are all dynamic language guys. Smalltalk is a dynamic language, so this is a framework and piece of software that you might be interested in learning more about. So, Smalltalk is all about objects and messages, and Ruby has a lot of similarity to that. If you know, some of the things I've read that Matt has said about Ruby is that he was heavily influenced by Smalltalk when he created it. So, there's a lot of similarity between the way the two languages are set up. In Smalltalk, everything's an object, and you can only interact with objects by sending them messages. So these three things you see on the screen here are the three kinds of messages you can have in Smalltalk. You either have messages that have no arguments, like server would be the object, start is the message. Plus is actually a message there that is not a primitive operation. In fact, in Smalltalk, there are two operators. There's assignment and return. All your arithmetic stuff is just messages. So in Smalltalk, the metal is pretty far down, as it were. And then down there at the bottom, where you see the colon, that's what's called a keyword message. All that really means is that's the way you pass messages. This is actually one of the cool things about Smalltalk, because it's very hard, as opposed to a language like C or Java. When I used to be a C programmer, if I had a function call that had two or three or four arguments in it, and some of them were, you know, a bunch of them were integers, it's really easy to get them mixed in order, whereas in Smalltalk, that's virtually impossible. Well, I shouldn't say virtually impossible. You can write Fortran in any language, and I have seen plenty of people whose notion of good OO code is to have arrays of arrays of arrays of arrays. I can tell you horror stories about a telecom company that's closer to my neck of the woods than yours. I come from Maryland, as it happens, and I could tell you some horror stories about people who believe that everything should be in arrays. So you can, in fact, write obfuscatory Smalltalk code as well as you can write obfuscatory code in any language. But in general, if you're not doing that, it's pretty easy to figure out what's going on in Smalltalk. So this slide here, I've compressed this down. I'm not pretending that you can read all of this unless your eyes are really good. I compressed it to fit on this slide. What this is the entire syntax of Smalltalk, though. And what's kind of cool about this is that if you buy a book on, say, a language like Java, the first 50 or 60 pages are explaining the basic syntax, and here I have all of Smalltalk on one slide. There are five reserved words in Smalltalk: true, false, nil, self and super, and that's it. Those are the reserved words. So everything else is just messages. The library in Smalltalk is enormous because most things are not built in. Most things are part of the library. So control structures, they're part of the library. They're not built in. So that means that you can build your own control structures, and they live at the same semantic level as the ones that are in the library. So if you decide that some control structure that's not in the language fits with your framework, the nice thing about it is that it lives at the same semantic level as everything in the library already. Now, team development. There are a bunch of things out there. The Smalltalk is different than Ruby in one very important way, and that is that in Ruby, there is one reference implementation. Now, there's some variances around because there's an implementation that runs on the .NET platform now that has a small amount of variances, I think. The one that runs on the Java platform, JRuby, has a small amount of variance, but for the most part, Ruby is Ruby. In Smalltalk, there are multiple dialects, and different dialects operate different ways. There's a fully open source one called Squeak. There is our product, CINCOM Smalltalk. We are not open source in the sense that we're, you know, free as in beer, but if you grab our non-commercial version, which you can download from the website listed there, syncomsmalltalk.com, all the source is exposed, nothing's hidden. You can see everything that's going on. So it's open source, and I put air quotes around that, in the sort of 80s and 90s understanding of that term, not in the way we talk about it now. There are other implementations out there. Gemstone's another interesting one. If you're interested in object-oriented databases, there's an interesting implementation of CSide on Gemstone, where you're actually running CSide inside the database application server, which is kind of cool. You can download that from their website, too. So here's one of the things that I like to say is interesting about Smalltalk, and I'll demonstrate this in a couple of minutes. In most languages, when you hit the debugger, what you are is you're a forensic pathologist. The best you can do is try to figure out what it is that killed your code. In Smalltalk, you're a surgeon. The code isn't dead yet. You can patch it up and send it on its way. The thing that Microsoft calls fix and continue, the sort of kind of works in the .NET environment, it's actually worked in Smalltalk for years. And I'll demonstrate that in a minute. And that's pretty much all I have for slides. I want to get straight into code. I just wanted to do a brief overview there. And what I have here, let me throw the browser down for a minute. What you're looking at here is the base Smalltalk environment. I brought up this window at the top as the launcher. Can everybody see that? Because I'm kind of sideways to it, so I don't know if you guys can see that. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to load before I even load CSide, let me just do something real simple. This is the browser, and this is the tool that I'll be working in to do some of the demonstrations. This is where you build code in Smalltalk. And the way this works is the leftmost pane is packages. And if I want to create a new one to do a little example, like I'll create a new package and I'll call it counter. And if I want to have a new class, I create it here. And I would call this class counter. I will let it descend from object. And I'll give it an instance variable called count, an attribute. Hit OK. And there's my class. Over here in these next two panes, you see the third one, that is protocols. The way we organize code in Smalltalk is instead of having a text editor in which you edit, you have this four-pane browser. That third pane is where the methods are categorized. Now, you don't have to really pay any attention to that if you don't want to. You'll notice that I can go over here and start looking at the code immediately. So I can come over here, for instance, and say, well, by default, my count really ought to be zero. And then I can compile that by hitting Control S. Now, compiling, in this sense, just means that I've compiled it to bytecode. When this runs, everybody here familiar with what a JIT is, a just-in-time compiler? Smalltalk has a JIT behind it, so that when you run in deployment mode, it will compile down to platform executable, and once you're running, it's in platform executable. Now, that code cache is thus and such big, and that's configurable, so you can kind of make it big if your code's big and small if your code's small. You can decide what's more important to you, space on in memory or, you know, having lots of stuff run at executable speed. So let me give you a small example here of a new method. I'm going to create a new method, and I'm going to call it add1. And I'm going to do something stupid here. I'm going to say count gets count plus, and I'll make a fairly simple boneheaded mistake. This is legal small talk, by the way, even though it's not going to work. The single quotes are for a string, so I'm trying to say count gets the current count plus the string 1. And that's going to break, but there's a purpose behind me breaking that. Let me do this. I'm going to create a new instance of this. And I just send the new message to create a new one, and then I'm going to send the add one message to the result of that. And you'll notice that that broke. And the message it comes up with here is somewhat obvious if you're a small talker, maybe less so if you're not. What it's trying to tell you is you try to send a summation of an integer to a byte string, and it has no clue what you're trying to do there. But, like I said, this is where you're not a forensic pathologist. You bring up the debugger, and let me make this a little bigger. And I come down here to the line of code I recognize as mine, and I notice that the reason it's broken is that for some reason I put in a string there. Now watch what happens when I hit Control S. Notice the stack rearranged itself. That's because I'm in the middle of executing the code. I recompiled that method, and the stack changed because it just threw away the stacks that were forward in the future from that. This is, by the way, why continuations work in Smalltalk, is because of this kind of thing. So now I will hit run, and it'll just work. Now, you didn't see anything because I didn't do this inspect. And if I do inspect and look at that, it comes up with the expected value of 1. This is another one of the interesting tools in Smalltalk as an inspector. At any point, you can go in and look at the way things work. So that's a brief introduction to one of the cool things about Smalltalk is this whole fix and continue metaphor. Let me take that a step further, though. I'm going to throw the browser away for a minute. I'm going to bring in Seaside. Now, to bring in Seaside, I'm going to load a package. I'm going to come into this package loading tool, select Seaside Web Development, and select the Seaside package, and then I'm just going to tell it to load. Now, when it finishes, you're going to see a browser fly up because it's going to immediately start the server in kind of development mode for me. And it started it off screen a little bit. Move that over. So this is the basic Seaside development panel. And I mean development in the sense that if you deployed a website, you wouldn't want this configuration screen coming up. Now, just to show you something that's fairly basic, I'll go in here to examples, and I'll bring up this counter. This is kind of the canonical Seaside application example. I'll show you the code for this in just a minute. Fairly basic. All you have there is a little link down at the bottom for plus and a little link next to that for minus. One of the interesting things about this compared to most web frameworks is this. Let me hit plus a couple times, get myself up to 4. Now I'll hit back. Now when I hit plus, what do you think the answer is going to be?
5.
Five.
Nope.
No.
Oh. Because I unwound the stack. This is continuations. I've unwound the stack and gone back in time, as it were. When I hit the back button, this is one of the cool things about Seaside, is without me really having to do anything, the back button works the way the end user expects it to work. Now, you can turn that off, and I can see some skepticism. And the reason is that, say, for instance, if you were doing a banking application, you probably wouldn't want the user to be able to go back and say, deposit $1,000 5 or 20 times. So you can tell it which pieces of state to allow this for and which ones not. There is a piece of the framework where you can specify what to either, you know, what state to allow to have this backtracking for and what state not to allow this backtracking for. So you can have that not work. But the cool thing is that without having to do much, it works. Which means that for most cases, for most purposes, the back button functions for the end user the way the user expects the back button to work. It does the right thing, as it were. And you know, the interesting thing is that this is one of the reasons that web apps have historically been hard for people. It's just dealing with what happens when you hit the back button. There's all this back and forth of state messages going to the server.
So does this actually keep a local application state in the browser space and is transmitted each time? Which,
if you look at the very top there, that text that's probably hard to read, you see the S equals something and then K equals something. Mm-hmm. That is a cryptographic state reference that goes back to the server. All the state's actually in the server.
Okay.
The state is not on the client.
Because I know ASP.NET holds a local state.
Yeah,
and transmits it every time.
Right, and this doesn't do it on the client. What this is doing is it has this state. There's a session object back on the server. And how big that session object gets depends on how much state you've instructed it to hold on to. It can get very big if you tell it to hold on to everything. It can be very small if you tell it to hold on to not much. But that state information is retrieved by setting those two variables up to the server in the URL. Now, before the next question that often comes up at this point is, well, I want a clean entry point URL, and I see this ugly thing with all those ugly characters in it. You can, in fact, define entry points pretty easily. That's part of configuration of your application. So you can do that. You can give your end users clean entry points into different parts of your application. For instance, if you want to do the canonical example of a blog server, you can give them an entry point for each individual post, that kind of thing. And the same thing goes for to-do apps and so on and so forth. So that's possible. Now, here's the cool thing, though. Let's go here, turn that down for a moment. Let's go ahead and I will build the simplest Seaside application that could possibly work.
Hello, world.
Yeah. Hello, world, if I can actually spell it. So we'll build this. We'll create a new class called Hello. We'll be very, very... original. Now, the thing I need to do here is, since I'm using Seaside, I can't descend from object. What I'm going to descend from is something in the Seaside namespace called WA component. Now, in Seaside, everything that you want to have be a displayable component is going to descend from this. The reason the WA is there is that Seaside, and this is one of the, remember I said a few minutes ago that there are multiple dialects of Smalltalk? Seaside runs in almost all of them. And within a few weeks, probably I can say all of them. There's one from instantiations that it does not yet function in. It will probably function in that by the end of this, well, summer ends the 21st, I believe. And what their product manager said a couple weeks ago, it should be running by the end of summer. But you know, I can't guarantee that it's not my product. But in any case, WA is their namespacing for that, because not all small talks are namespaced. Some of them still have one global namespace. So they prefix all their classes with this WA. So in any case, I create this component. Seaside is ultimately component-based assembly. I hit return and something weird. There we go. Seaside is ultimately component-based assembly. When I describe a web page in Seaside, you'll notice that when I do this, at no point am I bringing up a text editor and creating an HTML file. And the reason for that is I don't ever do that. I don't hand create HTML or ASP style code anywhere in this. What I do is I create a method called render. You'll notice my typing skills are coming out now. Render content on, and that HTML is an argument that is sent in by the framework. It's an instance of a brush, basically. And this is the way you do things in Seaside, is you take this brush that knows how to paint HTML, and you tell it what HTML to paint, but you send it Smalltalk messages, not HTML. Now, if you wanted to emit HTML and you have a bunch of HTML to hand it, for instance, you're building a corporate website and there's a footer that just has to go at the bottom and it comes from the corporate marketing guys and you're never going to be able to change it unless you go kill people, you can tell it to emit, not that I have any notion of what that means, you can give it straight HTML to emit. So, say HTML text and string. Hello world. Now, a couple other things I have to do to this in order to get it to display. What I need to do is I need to add two little messages. I'm going to call it can be root, meaning I can be a root level component, and I'm going to add true to that. Now, this is not a method I have to add, but I have to execute this code, but I'm going to make it a class side message.
Is the indentation for style, or is this like Python?
It's just for style. It doesn't mean anything. And I can't type, so I'm letting it correct for me. So, the indentation doesn't mean anything except other programmers. And the nice thing is, though, there's a formatter built into this. If I pop up the context menu, you're going to see here that there's an option called format. And this is one way to make sure you don't get into formatting wars, is that the standard way to format across teams is just to use that. But Smalltalk standards tend to be fairly simple. I don't think I've ever seen a formatting war in Smalltalk, and partly that's because we don't look at code in large text editors. I'm not saying this is a bad thing. I'm just saying in Smalltalk we don't do that. So because we only tend to look at 5 to 7 lines of code at a time, it's really hard to get into nasty battles about code formatting when you're only looking at 5 to 7 lines of text. I mean, it can be done. I've seen people who are capable of having that kind of argument. But in general, we don't get into wars over that kind of thing in Smalltalk. We get into other wars, certainly, just not that particular one. So I'm going to execute this particular line of code. And now I'm going to bring up my browser again. And I'm going to go back out to the top level here. Now you'll notice there's a new thing here. And there it is. So, not a terribly exciting application, but notice that at no point did I open up a text editor, and the only way I emit HTML is to do this.
Can I see the source, the HTML source?
Not easily.
Oh, okay, never mind.
Well, no, what I mean by that is...
I mean, just the source.
No, well, you'll see what I mean by not easily.
Oh, I see. There's no...
It's not pre-printed.
Yeah.
And kind of the purpose behind this is, you know how the people behind Ruby on Rails say Ruby on Rails is opinionated software? Seaside is the same kind of thing, and it's not built the same way as Ruby on Rails. It has very little in Ruby on Rails and Seaside are very different kinds of web frameworks, but it's got one thing in common, and that is the Seaside is opinionated software, and one of its opinions is you shouldn't be doing that. And I don't mean that in a nasty way. It's just that since you never write HTML straight, you're always in here in that component in the browser. Push this aside. You're always in here doing this kind of thing. And the other nice thing about this is since you're creating your HTML in methods like this, when you want to change your HTML, you refactor your code. So if you have a method that gets to be too long, and you notice I'm emitting what really ought to be four or five components from one piece of text, I refactor it the same exact way you refactor any method in Ruby or Smalltalk or any other language. You decide that code's too long, I want to refactor it. And you can do that by hand, or this, not that I can show it to you easily here because there's not a lot going on, but you'll notice that there is a refactor option in the browser here, and I haven't selected anything, so it's not going to allow me to extract. But if I had code here that was worth extracting, I could extract it out. So one other thing I want to briefly bring up before I go on to something a little more advanced. In the parcel manager here again, you'll notice if I go down a little bit, there are a lot of things that are built in pieces of CSide that are optional. We've built in Scripaculous support. So again, with Scripaculous, you don't write the JavaScript directly. It's integrated into the Smalltalk. There's an updater object, and when you want to tell the system there's this portion of a page I want to be dynamically updated, you just tell the updater to do that. So again, you stay in Smalltalk. There are pros and cons to this approach, but the pro side of this is that everything is in front of you. Everything is contextual. You're all in one place at all points. And when you debug, you're not going back and forth from HTML page to code. You're doing exactly what I was doing when I did the debugging a couple of moments ago. You're in the code, and you're just in the zone. So it's kind of a cool thing. The other thing is the way you make this look nice, and don't ask me to design this, because CSS is something that I'm actually very dangerous with. You could ask some of our developers. You just style it. So you hand this, there's a method that CSide understands called styles, and you just hand it a CSS either directly in the code or as an external file reference, and let Apache serve it, and then you get nice looking pages, presuming that you found somebody that knows how to do that. Wouldn't be me, but presuming you found somebody that knew how to do that. So let me kill this environment, though. I want to bring up something a little different here. And I'll put this over aside there. Now, what I'm showing you now is something a little bit different. This is a CSide-based development environment that takes this whole web development metaphor kind of one step further. And that is that this is CSide behind this, but you're doing your development and displaying everything right here in the browser. So this is there's a Ruby development framework whose name escapes me at the moment. I blogged on this about 2 months ago, and I can't remember right now. There is a Ruby framework trying to do the same thing. So this is not that oddball an idea. What you're looking at here, though, is the development environment for WebVelocity. The underpinnings of this are CSide, but everything's here in the browser. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to write that same Hello World application. Actually, before I do that, let me just explain what you're looking at on the screen. Over to the left, it's showing you that I can connect to various source code repositories. We run a public one. There's the personal one, which is an SQLite database that's running on that machine. And that would be the way you do this if you're running locally. Your personal repository would just be the SQLite locally. And then there's a community one we have up on a server at Syncom. In the middle, based on the one I'm connected to, which happens to be personal, there are the available applications. You might notice that I've done the Hello World application a number of times now. And then over there on the right is documentation. Now the documentation, I think, is kind of neat because this is integrated with the Smalltalk environment in a way that, generally speaking, it hasn't been. The way our documentation historically has been is a bunch of PDF files. So if I come over here, I can go to General, and it'll show me a little walkthrough, and I can go straight over here and start reading and getting some walking through of the environment itself, and I can always pop out to the top this way. So the nice thing about this is we've tried to make this an immersive environment so that you're always in the browser and you're never having to leave that contextual view. So let me create a sample application here. I'm going to call this, again, Hello World. I'm not going to make this a database app because the first thing I'm going to do is just, again, a simple example. And you notice it added something to the middle there, unpublished, meaning I have not published this to my repository. And here I have gone in and I'm now looking at my code. Here's where I put a comment that describes what this code is. Like most programmers, I'm going to willfully ignore that and leave the next follow-on developer to figure out what in God's name it was I was doing. So I'm just going to go straight in to creating a new class, and I'm going to create something called a new web component. This is going to be the same thing that I was doing out in the other environment. Oh, I know what's going on here. This happened to me when I was in Europe. Let me do this, clear private data, and let me clear all of this stuff. So let me just relaunch this. All right, so now let's create a new web component. Okay, so now I'm going to create my new web component. I'll call this hello. I'm going to register it as an application. Now, use template would mean that we have some scaffolding. Now, when you're doing database-driven web development, you probably want to use the scaffolding. For this silly little example, I am not going to use the scaffolding because I'm just building a hello world, so I'm going to leave that unchecked. What you're going to notice is that when I did this outside of the environment, there were a couple of messages I had to implement that were just kind of bookkeeping to tell the system you can find an entry point for this. You'll notice that I don't have to do that this time. As a matter of fact, I can go straight to entry points now and hit this. Now, it's not going to display anything because I haven't done anything yet. But it's displaying a nice, clean page. This is probably the most nicely designed page I've ever put out myself because there's nothing on it to deter from the nice whiteness here. At least none of the kind of stuff I normally fill on there, which is a bunch of tables and bad graphics. So let's go back.
It's a polar bear in a snowstorm.
Huh?
It's a polar bear in a snowstorm.
There you go. See, there's always an upside for somebody in the audience. So I'll come back to my component, and I'll go to source code, and here I am editing in the browser. Now, this is a slightly different experience than what I was doing in the browser, and that is that I'm right here in the... Here, so I will come back out here. It does the auto-tabbing for me, and then I can just say self... Or not self, I do HTML text colon hello. Now, notice how there, I've got a little indicator there. You see this little red mark over here? This box? What that's telling me is that this method so far is syntactically incorrect. And if I'm not a small talker who's very familiar with the environment, like probably most of you wouldn't be, personally, I've been around small talk long enough, what's going on here is blazingly obvious, but for a newcomer, it might not be. So instead of having the classic Smalltalk thing, which I could show you in a regular browser, if I tried to compile this, it would stick the error message in text in the browser, which is something I'm used to, but many neophytes look at that and say that's annoying. I understand where they're coming from, it's just that it's happened to me so long that I don't notice it anymore. Here, to see that error, I float the mouse right over that, and it tells me that I've got an unmatched string. So if I see something red in my environment here, it will tell me what I've done wrong. So at any point, I can just come over here and finish this, and you'll notice that two things happen. When I finish that, it takes the red away. The other thing is I don't actually have to accept this method. The cool thing that the developers added to this, I think just a couple weeks ago, is that at any point where this code is syntactically correct, it's compiled for me. So it does that in the background as I'm typing along. So at any point where I reach syntactic correctness, it saves the method for me. I don't have to remember to save it, it just does it. So at this point, this is in, and you notice that I do have syntax color highlighting. It might be hard to see on the screen. This red means this is a reserved word, super. And this blue means that it's a literal, a string. So if you're, again, a neophyte, you can look up in the documentation what that means, you can find out red means reserved word, blue means literal, so then you can figure out what it is you're looking at. And of course, this method is just black, which means it's just a method name. So that's all compiled for me now. So if I come back to here, and I were to reload this, there it is, it's displayed. Now, let's go back out here one more time, and let's do the same kind of thing I did before. I will do 1 plus string 1. And again, syntactically correct, but a problem because I'm trying to add a string and a number. And let's see what happens when I try to execute that. Now, I get the debugger like I did before, but I'm getting it in the browser. The cool part of this is that unlike the seaside environment I was showing you a few minutes ago, when I hit debug here, it stays in the browser for me. So I have my debugger implemented right here in the browser. Notice the blue highlighting. What it's doing is it's telling me where I am in the middle of trying to execute when it got this don't know how to add string and number thing. So it's showing me down here where I'm at. And
If I come down here and put the cursor down and start deleting that one, notice it's already rewound the stack, by the way. 1 plus 1. Now it's telling me the next thing I'm going to execute is that line above there. And I can come up here and just say run, and it runs. So I stayed in my flow. I was in the browser. I was in the middle of a hit. It broke. I fixed the break, and then it kept me in the browser. And no point did I have to have 20 windows flying out. This is kind of a cool thing, I think.
And then fix it in source, though. That was just in that one request.
No, actually, I fixed it in source. Let's come back here.
That's amazing.
And look here. Here's my source. If I refresh this.
Wow, that's cool.
It fixed the source.
So how do you deploy this? What did this actually create? What physical is there that I have to push to a server?
Okay, let's do this.
Make a real application.
If I take up here, let's go back out to this level here. And notice this is not published. So let's go ahead and publish this. And what it's going to do is it's going to publish to my local repository. Getting into that broken JavaScript thing again, I think. Clear this out. This is happening to me last week in Europe. All right. If I do, let me load something out. Let me do this, then I'll just deploy it. If I want to deploy this, publishing it would load. Actually, that should, I think that did. Let's go look. Yeah. It's in, what directory is it in? I didn't want to load Colloquy. It just popped up because I missed. There's, LSAUTO. Okay, it didn't publish it. And the reason it didn't publish it is, again, I have a cache problem right now that I need to clear out. So let me do that again.
I have a cache problem too, but it's something.
Let me clear my private data again. Let's try reloading this. Okay.
Your cache is lingering. Mine doesn't stay long enough. That's my problem.
That might be a problem I have too. I'm just not going to reveal that on a live recording. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to publish this into my repository. This is just a comment I can put here, hello world, and I hit OK. And oh, it's already exists, so I've already got this in the database. Oh, that's why it was giving me grief.
We have hello world 1.0 already.
Yeah, so let's cancel this. Let's rename this. Let's rename it to
Goodbye World.
And we'll take the audience suggestion, goodbye world. Now let's publish that. And now it's going to give me the opportunity to do this. Another hello example. And we'll hit OK. And now it says it's loaded. So now I can come in here and do a deploy. And now it's telling me that it's put it into that directory. So now let's look there, ls autoload. And you'll see there's this thing down here. It's probably very hard for you to see down here, but I've got a package in that directory. That's a directory that when I start the environment up, it will autoload whatever it finds there. And it's not set up this way yet because we're still in beta. But when you go to production, anything that finds and loads in there, it would kind of put you into deployment mode and give you just a top level URL for that instead of the whole development environment. The idea is that you deploy this way, and then you just run.
So those two files go to my server.
Actually, just this one, as it turns out. This is source code.
Oh, okay.
So this is binary and source. This is the only one. You take the image file, the VM file, and that. And the image file is, only a few of you are familiar with Smalltalk, so do you know what I mean by an image file? Okay. All of you have, well, you have a notebook, and you know what it means to hibernate a notebook, right? Mm-hmm. Notebook takes a snapshot of the running environment it takes an image of your running environment. That's what Smalltalk image is. It's a snapshot of the running Smalltalk image. So you deploy that snapshotted image, that parcel file, that PCL file in the autoload directory, and then the virtual machine that runs the whole thing. So basically, you need three files. And then, of course, some way to tie it into the Apache server, which, generally speaking, is a Perl CGI script.
CGI.
Or you can do proxy pass stuff too. I mean, you can just set it up running on, say, port 7777 like I have there and do proxy stuff. So it depends on how you want to do that. Different web administrators like doing that different ways. I don't like to argue with them. They get picky. So let me go in here and build a new application, though. So we'll come up here and we'll create a new application. This time we're going to make it a database application. And I'll come up with a name that I know I haven't used before, so I don't get into the same problem again. Some blog server. And we'll come up here to some blog server. And I first need to go to database settings. And here I will assure you that I do in fact have a Postgres database on this machine. So there's pgadmin. So I have a Postgres database and it's got tables in it. So I'm going to tell it to use Postgres. And then I'm going to tell it where to find it. So I'm going to say localhost 5432.
You've mentioned Postgres, you've mentioned SQLite, I assume MySQL also.
MySQL was on that list.
I just saw a long list there, yeah.
Yeah, everything that was on that list is a possibility.
Okay. There's no
MSQL.
Yeah, it's just called SQL Server.
SQL Server.
SQL Server.
Okay.
Yeah. SQL Server, yeah, it's a, there are different names for that different people have. Let's see if I can remember what database, what password I gave it on this machine. Actually, first I have to see if I can actually type all the letters. Assuming I can type all the letters.
PASSWORD.
Password would have been a smarter one because I would have had a hard time forgetting that, but I had to be clever. So now it's configured. And I've just unplugged my power, I think. There we go. So now it's configured. So now I go down here to my database schema. And I have source code. Well, actually, before I do that, let's create some persistent models. So I'm going to create a persistent model called Post. Okay? And I'm going to create another persistent model called Comment. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to go back to my schema. And I'm going to come in here to this. Now, what we're using here is something that anybody who's worked with Ruby on Rails is going to be somewhat familiar with. This is an active record pattern. So I've got an active record framework that's built on top of a larger object relational framework that we call by a very highly tuned marketing name called Glorp. Easy to remember. So that method up there, most of it's commented out. The double quotes are actually comments. So what I've got here is a method that is defining how this table and this Smalltalk code hook up to each other. So I'm going to use my little cheat sheet here and hook this up. So I'm going to say, and you'll notice the little red again because I've uncommented something. So I'm going to say, I want to have a title, and that should be platform varchar. And then I want to have some content. So I'm going to create content and call that text. And then finally, I want to have something called created. And I'll call that timestamp. Take off the comments. And now I have my mapping between the post table and the Smalltalk code. If I come down here to the post class and go to the variables, or the mappings rather, you'll notice that it's already telling me that it thinks I ought to add some attributes because I've defined this mapping and it's looked at the mapping and it's looked at the database and said, by the way, it would probably behoove you to go ahead and add these. So I'll add this mapping and this one and this one. It does all that for me. And at this point, I can go out to my entry points. And you notice that it already has a bunch of these preset. It knows about Adam, it knows about JSON, it knows about, you know, the new entry point and post entry point. And this is using the basic scaffolding, so I'm going to just hit this one. And the layout for this is not perfect. It's just a scaffolding layout that's giving me something that's semi-reasonable. So let me go ahead and create a new one. And based on the database types it found, it's giving me, and again, there's no style on this. So assuming that you had a competent person defining style, you could make this look halfway decent. That's not really the purpose behind this example, but bear in mind that it doesn't have to look this bad, unless I'm writing it. So I'm going to call this my second post, because that way it won't show you that I did this earlier today. And I will go ahead and save that. Now, just to show you that it's in the database, let's go ahead and open up this Postgres admin. And just to show you that there's nothing up my sleeve, we'll go ahead and we'll connect to this, and we'll go look at the tables, look at posts. It's telling me that I have a row. So there's the row I just put in, so let's move that aside. If I come in here, I can select this, and now I can edit it. I can add some text, save it, and now it did that. So I can also go ahead and delete it and blow stuff away. So all of that basic functionality is built in. So again, the scaffolding that's behind us, let me just show you what's going on here. We'll go back out to the entry point here in Safari. Let's go over here to the web, to this blog server here. And let's take the post list UI, this class here. So this is the thing that gives me the list of posts. Now if I go up here and I want to see the source code, I'll notice that I've got basically no code here. But the reason for that is that most of the code is up top. So I have this post list UI as the class it created for me, but it created it for me in here. Notice that when I select one class up the hierarchy, it suddenly showed me a bunch of new stuff. This is where, if you wanted to change the way things displayed, you would go in and start mucking with these methods. Not in that superclass. You'd probably want to leave the superclass alone. You derive your own version of it in the subclass and start mucking with it.
You're saying there's HTML in those methods?
Not HTML, the same kind of code I was showing you before. So if I go into render object, it's doing this kind of thing where it's saying render the variable name, copy is capitalized, render object. This is not terribly easy to read code here, but this is just rendering a basic object.
The HTML variable is down there.
Yeah, down at the very bottom.
The message to put an anchor in.
So let me scroll down a little bit and make that a little more obvious. To see here, so render objects on maybe is a little more obvious. So here we have render object, which goes in here. Render the headings might have a little, see here, table row. So it's putting out that table at the top. You know, when I had that, it gave me the table for the three, for the four, the attributes, the title, the content, and so on. That's how it's rendering it. It's rendering a table row and iterating across the variables. This is just an iteration. Variable names is a collection. It's saying do is a method that iterates. It's saying iterate across all my variables. And for each one of them, put out a table heading with render heading. And if I want to change the way that looks, I just go into the render heading method and I change that.
There's no template.
No template.
You're actually coding Smalltalk, which is generating HTML.
Right.
Yeah, like where it says HTML table heading,
right,
it's going to put a... What is
right.
That?
So it's like a library call.
It's a library call. It's exactly a library call. Like I said, the way you do this is that when you want to change your code, you just refactor. So there is no templating. The templating you use is CSS. So instead of templating with a page that you fill in gaps in, you template your CSS. You create a style, and then you take that and modify it.
Does this by default provide IDs and class and all the stuff you need, the hooks you need for CSS?
Yeah, and that's actually documented. That's all going to be documented.
But the thing is
that you can do that yourself. Let me go back out here to...
And who generated all that? Was that Glorp? Is it Glorp that...
The database stuff is all Glorp underneath the hood, which is a framework we have. It's not a relational framework. But this code is scaffolding. This is a superclass of. Remember what I did to get here was I went to the very top here and I said my visibility is set currently to look up at this abstract class. This is the class that got generated for me. Okay, notice there's virtually no code in here. So if I go to rendering, there's nothing here. I could write a new one, and I would do that if I wanted to change the way one of my inherited methods displayed things. So if I come up here again to generic list UI, so if I come up here and let's take render actions on, HTML button callback create object with new, let's do this. So we'll change that, and now we'll go back out here to the entry points. Notice the change. Now I changed that the wrong way. I changed it in the superclass. I should have actually derived the method down below and overridden it instead of changing the superclass, but the point is, to change things, I change code. I don't muck with a template. So it's a different approach. I'm not going to argue with you on that. It's a different approach than most frameworks, including Ruby on Rails, use. It is not the same as most frameworks do.
So if I was creating a web app in Seaside, and I put together a prototype for my client, mm-hmm. Right? Client likes it, approves the functionality,
I have my graphic designer create a mockup, make it pretty. I then take the HTML that they give me and translate that into different methods in my code, which generate the HTML which my graphic designer gave me.
Now, you're going to hook into the CSS that your graphic designer gives you.
I think you probably do the same thing that I did when I created...
they're going to give me a different HTML.
Yeah, that's I see that as an issue, too.
This is actually
going to give me back totally different HTML than the...
This is similar to what I did, to be honest, when I created... Let me go to this. This is outside. Let me go to this just to show you what I'm going to explain. When I did this, blog server, I wrote this in a server pages servlet style. But as I said, I don't know much about CSS. And when I created this, what the guy who gave me this said was, here's the CSS, and he gave me a mock-up page with pretty much HTML on it with bogus posts. And he said, make sure your server generates stuff that matches this. And so when I generate this stuff here, I don't necessarily save this with the right kinds of ID tags and divs around it. My server makes sure that each post that was put up has the right tags wrapped around it. So I do the same thing, not at Seaside, but in a different web framework. So yes, you would get CSS from a graphics designer, and then you would make sure that your code spit out the right stuff. And the way you wrap things in divs, in this is just HTML, you know, it's the brush div, colon, and then what's inside the div.
Okay, so there's no way to take HTML and then put Smalltalk inside it.
You can emit raw HTML, there's a way to do it. There's just a message in WA component. There is a message to emit raw HTML, and you just hand it scads of raw HTML if that's what you want to do. And I suppose you could extend it that way to create templating, but it's generally speaking not the way Seaside is designed. Seaside is not really designed as a templating solution. And the interesting thing is I had that exact discussion with the designer of Seaside, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, Abby Bryan. And we went back and forth much the same way you are with me. It took me probably a good 3 years to get to the idea in my head that this might be a valid approach. And I'm not saying that templating is a bad approach. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying this is a valid approach. It is not the only valid approach. It works very well for a lot of cases.
But the HTML that scaffolding spits out, does that include any CSS type attributes?
The HTML that it spits out, it has divs and IDs.
It does have divs with IDs.
It doesn't have to. You can spit out HTML.
No, what I'm saying, in theory, I could use the scaffolding, and then I could create a style sheet. And
yes.
That's all I have to do. Okay.
Yes, you create a style sheet, and you just
make sure...
It's
probably like div 1 or top level, but
whatever
it is, it doesn't matter what it's called, but it will spit it out for me that way.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And our scaffolding does that, but there's nothing stopping you from producing your own. I mean, the scaffolding that we're using here is just an example. So... In general, that's what you do, though. You create a style sheet, and then you just make sure you're emitting the right divs and IDs. The right classes, the right IDs, all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
Which is very similar to, again, what I did in my own blog server. Somebody provided me CSS and just told me, when you wrap your post objects, make sure they're inside this.
And then it'll look pretty.
And then it'll look pretty. And he said, if they don't match that, it'll look bad. And sure enough, he was right. Because every so often I screwed up, and I put a fix in my blog server, and it wasn't a fix. The one danger of Smalltalk is that you can fix it so easily that you can run yourself into trouble if you do live fixing on a server. That blog server I was showing you, I patch it live on a regular basis. I just throw code at it as it's deployed. Every so often, it's a bad thing. But the nice thing is, I don't have to take it down and do that. Now, to go back to the web velocity for just a minute, let me go back over here. I can't show you this functionality because I was trying this earlier today and it wasn't working right. But you notice this, this is still in beta again. Notice this option, synchronize tables. This is something that will be out before we go to production with Web Velocity. Recreate tables would drop the tables and then recreate them based on those mappings I was showing you earlier. Synchronize instead would say, let's say that your database has these, has these four columns in it. And I have since changed my domain objects so that they have a different set of attributes than what's in the database. Synchronize will do a migration without destroying your data. So the idea is that it's nice for a demo for me to be able to do this cool thing where I drop the tables and then recreate the tables. That works great in a demo. It doesn't work so great when you've got 6 or 7 or 12 months or a year or two of data sitting in the database and somebody tells you the right way to fix that is to drop the tables. So we do have code database migration work, not quite working in this particular build, but the developers tell me it should work. So I have to go back and see what that means, but that is under development. That's pretty much all I had to show. Is anybody have any further questions?
What inspired the name Seaside? Because you're there in Maryland by the years?
You know, I should remember this because there was a guy who gave a talk, actually. No, I don't even have it. The video is on my a hard drive at home. There's a guy, one of the guys who's a developer on it, explained this. It actually has an acronym meaning behind it. Wow. And the acronym's not serious. I get the distinct impression that it was derived over about 5 or 6 or 20 beers. Because they gave it they had it as kind of a sarcastic take on enterprise development. Mm-hmm. So one of the E's in Seaside is enterprise, but there's a bunch of other silly words around it.
Okay.
So I don't know, it doesn't mean anything really. I mean, mm-hmm. It's just a name that they came up with and then they wrapped some words around it.
I have a question. So you've got posts and comments. I'd be interested to see how if you said it's sort of using an Active Record design pattern, how do you tell it has many or belongs to?
Yeah, let me, instead of trying to code that for you, because I'd have to, what I'll do, the simplest thing I can do here is just to load the example from my repository. So let's do this. I will unload this, and then I will load this one. And this is how I load. Notice there are a couple of different versions. I'm going to load the second one because that one is mapped to my database as opposed to one that exists in Cincinnati. So the way that works is I come in here to this database schema. Let's look at the source. So the way this is mapped, notice that I have this. Here's my foreign key relationship where I'm adding the post, the foreign key relationship and this post ID between the tables. And then if I come over here...
Did you add that or was that generated for you?
This code had to be written. Okay. This schema code had to be written. But if I come over here to post and I look at the variables, it has a variable called comment. So from a code perspective in your domain object, all I have is this comments variable. And if I look at the source, that is actually just an ordered collection. So from the standpoint of my code, it looks like the map, this post has many comments, is already handled for me through that foreign key relationship. So it knows to go.
Did you write that code too?
No, that got done for me through the object relational mapping stuff. It saw the relationship between the tables.
In the foreign key. It saw the foreign key and generated that for you.
Not this. I had to create this code here, but it maps that.
You had to initialize it to the order collection?
Yeah. I had to initialize that to an order collection.
Okay.
But it put an instance variable in there.
Right.
How well does something like Seaside play with like a legacy database where there's... Because like a pretty common Rails idiom is that it's one table per model.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true here, or can you define a model?
Well, actually, the way this works is we have this active record pattern up here on top of an object relational framework. So we don't only have Active Record. We have this entire object relational mapping framework under it. And you can take some fairly complex existing legacy databases and map over to it. The Active Record framework works for the kinds of cases it works for, but you're not constrained to using only the Active Record pattern here. If you need to, get off the road, as it were, and drive off into off-road country with your legacy data, you can do that. You have to use Glorp, and you have to go down and write some code to do that, because the scaffolding will no longer do that for you. But you can go there.
So you got your models down there. We're looking at the post model right now.
We're looking at the post class here, and let me show you the comments class. The comment class. It's right here. It's the one in blue over here. And this one actually, all it has is this print on method. And just to show you what that means, if I come over here to the entry points, let's go ahead and do posts. I deleted everything, so there's nothing in here. I'll save that. And then I'll go over to it, and I will add a comment. And that printOn method is what made it do this dash line thing. Okay. So that was the only code of record and comment, was to have that dashed line between the person who posted it and the text itself.
Could we take a look back at the editor? I just want to try to understand the different layers of the framework.
Okay, which editor are you talking about? The code editor?
Back there. So you've got your models, you've got the views.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these are the views.
What do those look like? What's the source code for that again?
Okay, this guy doesn't have much code in it, but it does have this. It's got this.
This is an example of adding stuff to it. So the post view UI had to have this notion of, instead of just having save and delete and edit, it had to have this add comment added to it. So you notice what it does here is it says, add a button with the callback, add comment, and then this is the text. Now this callback notion I should mention, this is how you do what would be in most frameworks a servlet kind of response on the server. Here I'm saying put down a button, and when the button is pressed, this is the code that fires. And what's nice about this is that means that it's not hard to figure out what's happening when the button's pressed. And if it's a set of complex actions, you can trace it pretty easily. I can come right here and try to find out. You know, I can look right at this add comment and find all of the messages that implement that. So there it's going to show me all of the implementers and references right there. So I can go right in and find all the references to it in line, so I can just pull that up. So the nice thing about this is that I don't have to hunt around between different objects to find where these are. Oh, I think I hit delete by accident.
Yeah, why isn't the syntax highlighting telling you there's an error there?
Well, because self is legal.
Self is legal. Okay, yeah. Just reload the page.
Yeah, it just won't do anything. So I hit the delete key is what happened. So
do we want to trace into that and see what the add comment says?
Yes.
Yeah, so let's go ahead and highlight
that.
Pull that
button and it's going to run the add
comment. That's a bug. So let's go here, implementers.
Oh, you're in.
Oh, no, actually it's showing me right here.
You're in the same object.
What it is it's showing me. When I put the mouse over it, if you notice, when I flip the mouse over it, it's showing me that's what it's doing. So it's showing me, and I'm actually in the same place.
It's showing you the actual add comment code, yeah.
Right, it's showing me the actual add comment
code. You have to summarize the code.
You have 5 seconds.
Now, it should actually, the thing is, it should take me there. The fact that it's not taking me there is a bug in this build.
What's in the add comment action up there? What is that?
Yeah, we sure it's not because we're right on the same page where it would take you, or?
See the add comment action?
It's up there. It should expand that, though.
Yeah.
That's the method right there. It should expand it. Maybe it's not. Maybe it thinks I'm already there. It should have expanded. I call that a bug.
So it's creating a new comment.
Right. Creates a new comment. And then it does. Oh, this is and this call is an interesting feature of Seesaw. I should mention that too. Call is using continuations. This is the point where I take a new component and say call that onto the page, and it just interrupts this particular flow of control and jumps me over there. So the nice thing about this is that one of the nice things about Seaside from my perspective is that when you're building a GUI in Seaside, it's very similar to building a GUI in client-server style code. This is kind of like just putting a call in here that says open UI, comment edit UI. So you use call as the API here, but it's effectively the same as what I was doing client-server development, said open dialogue. And then when you're finished with the dialogue, take me back where I was. That's exactly what's happening here. And this is just the object being saved in the database.
So that's sort of like your controller.
Yeah.
The post view UI is sort of like your controller.
Yeah.
Well, then you're going to go to comment edit user interface. Mm-hmm. And it's going to have some buttons.
Right. So if I go over there.
An answer.
So right. If I go to comment view UI or comment edit UI,
comment
here.
Edit UI.
This doesn't have much. And the reason for that is that this is all provided by the scaffolding. So if I go up to generic edit UI, that's where I get all those. That's the scaffolding stuff. So this
but
is
it's going to return a true or false.
It's going to render based on what the actual data is. So that's why you don't have a bunch of stuff on the page. It looks at the instance variables and it's doing meta. You know, it's going meta on the attributes that I actually have.
Right. So that's saying if it's a text box rendered this, if it's an input box rendered this, like they're helpers almost.
Right.
Yeah.
That's exactly what they are.
But you make a good point. It returns a true, according to the other code, it looks like it returns a true or false, right?
Yeah,
I saw if true.
Right, depending on whether it was saved or not. You know, because if I go back to this, the way that worked
is, where was I, post edit UI? No, comment edit UI. No, post.
Post list.
Comment view.
Post view UI. Post. The add comment post here. Yeah, it's what it's doing is it's doing is if true.
If true.
Meaning if I hit OK, it's exactly like a dialog box. It's saying I have, you know, I popped up a comment editor, and then you can either OK or cancel it. If you cancel it, it never saved it. Because if it never happened, then it goes back. So again, this is why it's like building a client-server type UI, because you're right, you're in the same kind of mindset. You don't have this back and forth like you do in you know, servlets and server page type of stuff. So again, I'm not familiar enough with Ruby to draw direct Ruby on Rails to draw a direct comparison. I do know a fair amount about server page style development.
What's object?
Oh, object is just the domain object in this case, because this is code that is the way the framework works. The domain object that it's working on is called object. Maybe not the best name. I was
very creative. Better than me.
The developer needs to be slapped. I would probably call it model, but
he is not saying Visual Basic.
Developer's from Australia, so maybe he's upside down.
Probably.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's the domain object that's being operated on.
So you can all. So that's your controller, but that's also where.
That's the view app.
Here. Right, but we would think of it as a controller.
Right.
But that's also where your your code goes, which generates HTML.
Right. Well, it's not generating HTML from here per se. Notice what's happening here. It's saying, call this UI into existence, but that UI itself renders in comment view, in comment edit UI rather.
Right.
It's going to render ultimately based on this guy's render content on, which I don't even think this guy implements at this level.
It's right there.
Render content on? Is it
HTML content?
No, it's
that one.
I have to
override the render content.
What I have to do is I have to go one more level up. Maybe two. Probably two. Render content on is probably all the way up. Actually, it's got to be in here somewhere. Well, no, render content on is not directly called from this level. I could actually.
It's inherited.
Yes, it's inherited. But in any case, I know how to find this in the base Smalltalk environment. So let me go back out here. The other thing you can always do, of course, is you can always do this. I can always, let me get Firefox out of the way. I can always do this if I am the Smalltalk kind of developer I am. I can always do this. And I can do find class, generic, edit, UI. And I can go to rendering. Let's do the hierarchy. And then I can go up here. Find method. Render. There it is. It's in this level here. So that's what it's doing. Notice this thing here where it's doing make sure the table that I'm trying to deal on exists and I render the proper format method. And to follow this through, I can use standard Smalltalk browser type code to follow that through its execution. So you can edit either in the browser, as I was showing you, or you can go back to this environment, too. So you can do both.
In Rails, there's this plugin called Haml. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you guys familiar with Haml? You guys been with Haml?
Yes.
And what it allows you to do is take your HTML files and create another. It's sort of like another language above that, another sort of like. Allows you to generate HTML. It sort of takes HTML, so instead of doing like, a p-tag and mm-hmm. paragraphs, you just do like .p or something and then put in the code.
Right.
And some developers like it. I can see how it appeals to developers.
Is that code completer for you or something?
No, it's just the
syntax.
You write
it
like
code.
It's
like a
template. It's not really a template. You write less code. You write
hierarchy.
Yeah, you write hierarchy 3. And but it's the same sort of thing where it generates HTML for you. And I sort of discourage people from using it in their products because when you're working on a product and you hand it off to somebody else, it's like, well, the graphic designer is never going to be able to read this HTML code, right? Because it's in this other language, and it sort of devalues the code.
It's there in that language.
It's in HAML and it's not in HTML. And so if you have a graphic designer work on it, then, they're going to have to learn HAML.
They didn't hire the right graphic designer.
And so
could you switch back and forth?
Like when you build a definition?
No, not really. You have to start, you have to edit the HAML. So your graphic designer would work on it, and then you have to go back and change the HAML based on what they changed. Right?
Well, I do know the graphics designers work with most, I do know a number of shops that are doing Seaside for their websites and doing the professional development at Seaside. And they work with professional designers to build their stuff.
And how do... Okay, so we've launched a product, you know, there's something wrong, we need our graphic designer fixed on the web page, and they change the HTML mockup. They send it to the Seaside developer, and the Seaside developer looks at their code and compares it to the HTML code and figures out which line has changed, and then figures out what method to call in Smalltalk to generate that HTML and implement that.
I think generally what this means is that the graphics designer has to work a little more closely with the developers. It's not. I think what it amounts to is they can't be completely hands-off. They have to work more closely with the developers.
Right.
And Ruby does have something similar to this too, called marketing, which is using Ruby to generate the same thing as Smalltalk generating.
Right.
And then, you know, you get a little bit of benefit out of that in case you want to, like, create more powerful constructs, which you could do, like, in Smalltalk, too. If you use just the template HTML, then you're limited to, like, HTML's limited constructs.
Right.
Yeah, the interesting thing is this argument is hardly new. If you go back to and the reason I say that is that if you go back to when I started with Park Place in the early 90s, I remember, well, actually, just before I started, there was a new product that they were shipping called VisualWorks. Previously, they had this product called ObjectWorks, and the difference between the two was that VisualWorks had a GUI builder and ObjectWorks didn't. And there was actually an argument between the old-time small talkers at Park Place and product management, because product management really, really, really wanted a GUI builder to ship with the product. And the old-line developers insisted that they ship the product in two forms, one with the GUI builder and one without, because real men didn't write GUIs with a GUI builder. So, which was interesting because the person making the argument was Adele Goldberg, so she's not really male, so my joke doesn't completely work. But in any case, this is an old argument, and I'm not saying there's any right answer to it, but it's an old discussion point that people differ on whether the right thing to do is to get right down and write the base presentation code by hand, or whether you should have a tool do it. And this is something that's been gone, you know, people have gone back and forth on this one in GUI projects and in web projects for a very long time, and I don't know that there's any one right answer to it. This is just one way of approaching the problem that I think works pretty well in a lot of cases.
Are there any people using it? I know there's people, but any like top dogs using it?
Probably the most well-known application in Seaside, and it just migrated up to the latest release of Seaside, is this. DabbleDB.com. This actually is Abby Bryant's company. This is probably the best-known Seaside application out there. This is a database slash spreadsheet slash loose user data type application that a lot of people use to create their own reporting. So this is probably the best-known application written in Seaside out there. There are a bunch of in-house ones, but this is the best-known public one, I think.
And I can totally see how Seaside is great for this type of application. But is there any sort of like...
this guy's a hard sell. This one also, I'll say this is more an example of dog food eating than anything else. But the Seaside website, seaside.st, which is somewhere in Europe, this is a Seaside site also. And there is a blog... There are a bunch of people that have blogs that are linked here that are built in Seaside also. So there are more standard websites implemented in Seaside.
A little bit of style in there.
And this is just styling that produced that.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
And there is a fairly well-regarded application out of Switzerland called CMS Box, which is a content management system, and that's implemented in Seaside.
It was top five in one of the... website rating.
Some kind of award system. Yeah, I don't know which one, but yeah. There are systems out there being built in Seaside across a variety of domains. Again, I'm not here to tell you that this is what you should jump out and replace all your Ruby work with. This is something that if you're interested in dynamic languages and web development, I think it's another thing you ought to look into and perhaps consider. But I'm not trying to tell you that this is the best thing since sliced bread and that you should drop everything you're doing. I mean, I think it's the best thing since sliced bread, but that's what they pay me for.
We appreciate that.
With that session information, that kind of session information that gets passed in the browser URL, so that information kind of, I'm guessing, is stored in the Smalltalk running VM. Is that tied to, like, you know, that debugging kind of backtrace framework Smalltalk has built in?
Those session keys are on the server side in the image.
In the image. So, like, how well does it work if you want to have, like, multiple servers, like, you know, because you have all this, like, client-specific data tied to all these different users. So if you want to, like, create another server, is there, like, a central server that both can, you know, access the client-specific information from, or?
Well, it depends on how you want to structure it. I mean, the DabbleDB, the one that I had up a couple of minutes ago, they actually allocated an individual image for each user. They just have a big old set of racks of servers they do in co-location facilities, and they allocate an image per. There are other people that have multiple users per image, and, you know, this stuff scales actually pretty well, depending on how big you want things to go. I mean, I have a blog server that hosts like 25 blogs or so, and it's only one Smalltalk image, and it gets pretty decent traffic. I have fairly decently high Google rank. It really depends on what your constraints are. I mean, some people scale across multiple images, some people scale within one image. It depends on what your needs are.
But if you need to scale across multiple images, then you have, like, all the, you know, kind of tried and true, like, regular Smalltalk scaling across multiple images technology, as opposed to, like, anything CSI specific, right?
It's not CSI specific, but you scale across images typically by doing some kind of message passing between images. And there are frameworks for that. I mean, we have a framework in our product called OpenTalk, which is just a Smalltalk to Smalltalk messaging scheme. Mm-hmm.
Passing that key in the URL, is that not a security concern?
No, because it's cryptographically strong.
The browsers always have session IDs too. So
oh, that's true.
I mean, it's not
ridiculous. Yes. Okay.
Did you have a question over here?
I was. I considered if I could come up with it.
Okay.
All right.
Very interesting. Thanks for presenting it.
Well, thank you guys for coming out.
And I don't know exactly where in Maryland, but I know at least you're not from the Balmer area because you do have vowels in your speech.
I grew up in New York, actually.
Oh, okay. You sound a little New Yorker.
I'm from north of the Mason-Dixon line.
Yeah.
In this next segment, I have Dave Buck with this week's Cimbron Design Minute.
This is David Buck with today's Cimbron Design Minute. It's hard enough developing software in the first place. It's worse when the method names you choose lie about what the methods do. I recently ran across a case where a call to a method called update ended up performing checks to see if a user's login password expired or their system access had been revoked. If these events occurred, an exception would be raised, and the login process that called the update method would fail and report that the user couldn't log in. It took me longer than it should have to find out where these checks were being performed, because I always thought that the update method would be a benign refresh of a user interface. In another case, a method called hasValidData popped up a message box if the data wasn't valid. Again, the name of the method implied one operation, while the method itself actually did something different. It's important to name the methods based on what they actually do. If you co-opt a method to perform a different operation than its name implies, either find another way to do it or change the method name. This has been the Cimbron Design Minute. Cimbron offers training and consulting in object-oriented development and the Smalltalk programming language. For more information, visit www.cimbron.com or email info@cimbron.com.
In this segment, we have James Savage with the week's Smalltalk Jobs Report.
I'm James T. Savage, and this is the Smalltalk Jobs Report. Austin, Texas. Precision System Design has a 6-plus-month contract for a Smalltalk developer who has 3-plus-years Smalltalk experience. Experience that is considered a plus includes Envy, Java, C++, and C#. North America, United States or Canada. Syncom has a position for a senior tech support engineer, Smalltalk. They are looking for a Bachelor of Science, Computer Science, or equivalent 4-year undergraduate education, minimum 5 years Smalltalk experience, VisualWorks and Object Studio, minimum 5 years experience with COM, ActiveX, OCL, and XML, hands-on experience building and maintaining web applications, thorough familiarity with Oracle, MS SQL, and Windows Server, and hands-on skills with MySQL, PostgreSQL, DB2, SOAP, WSDL, Mail Protocols, Visual Studio, C, and C++, and etc. Experience that is considered a plus includes Linux, Unix, and Mac platforms. Quoting from the job posting, "This is a North American work-at-home position. All qualified applicants will currently reside and be work authorized within the United States or Canada. This permanent position pays $75,000 to $95,000 per year." These are just a few examples of the Smalltalk positions that are currently open across the world. For more details, visit our public directory page at xrl.us/smalltalkjobs. Or read my blog, Message Sends with an Undefined Object. As for this reporter's job search, one interview and one rejection down. So the quest continues. And as always, good luck with your job hunting.
Up next is Randall Schwartz with a quick look around the Squeak world with Squeak News.
This is Randall Schwartz here with your latest Squeak News. You can find all this news and more at news.squeak.org. Michael Persheed and his colleagues in the Software Architecture Group of Hasso-Plattner Institute have just announced the release of Squeak SVN, a tool to give Squeak access to the version control capabilities offered by Subversion, the open-source revision control system. This will allow Squeak developers to take advantage of the benefits of Subversion's growing popularity and support while remaining within the Squeak browser environment. Squeak SVN supports repositories using the HTTP, file, and SVN protocols, but there is currently no support for HTTPS. There are more details at the Squeak SVN project homepage, including a video of Squeak SVN in use. The new package was developed in cooperation with CollabNet, the primary corporate sponsor of Subversion. For Squeak Weekly News, this is Randall Schwartz. You can also check out my blog at methodsandmessages.vox.com.
If you enjoyed this week's podcast, please tell other people about it. We'd love to have more Smalltalkers and more developers learning about Smalltalk through the Industry Misinterpretations podcast. If you have feedback, send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com. Head on over to Facebook, join the Industry Misinterpretations group. Head on over to Ning and join the Smalltalkers group. Or head on over to Podcast Alley and cast a vote for the podcast. In the meantime, have fun with Smalltalk.